Welcome to the Total Brain podcast series, hosted by Dr. Evian Gordon, founder and chief medical officer of Total Brain.
Today's podcast is on five actions for a healthy heart and brain. And I am delighted to introduce our key opinion leader today, Pat Dunn. PhD, MS, MBA, FAHA, is the program director for Connected Heart Health and the American Heart Association's Inside Initiative for their new Center of Excellence for Health Technology and Innovation. Pat has a unique blend of knowledge and experience in healthcare, business development, software engineering, quality and research. Dr. Dunn is a clinical exercise physiologist and health educator with 35 years of experience in cardiac rehabilitation, preventive cardiology, and wellness, with specific expertise in digital health literacy and digital coaching methods. Pat, it's great to speak to you again.
Evian, thank you so much. It's such an honor and a privilege to be on your podcast. My colleague Patrick Waite and I have really enjoyed working with you. And yes, it's two Patricks, so Pat and Patrick from our Center for Health Technology and Innovation. But we've been working with you and your team at Total Brain, and it's really exciting times. What better time than now to really bring the heart and the brain together? It's a perfect time, and it's exciting to see what good work we're going to be able to do with that.
Well, it's been such a joy to work with you and Patrick and the American Heart Association and our research that we're doing together with Total Brain. And I couldn't agree with you more, Pat. The timing is extraordinary. There are two revolutions going on the planet today. The heart and brain. And with regard to the heart and body, immune system, gut biome, it's reverse it. And with the brain, it's rewire it. And that reverse it and rewire it, insight, new data, new methodologies, is breathtaking. The fact that Patrick and you have got such a great vision for implementing this on scale via the American Heart Association, it could not be more timely. What I want to do today, Pat, is really look at the overlap of the risk factors for heart and brain. And I'd like you to start, though, if you wouldn't mind. We like to occasionally start and end the podcast with five action takeaways. If you wouldn't mind quickly starting off by listing the takeaways so we can reinforce them throughout and end with them as well.
Sure, absolutely. So these are five things that people can do. So we, you know, sometimes we talk about the numbers, you know, getting your blood pressure and your cholesterol under control, which are important, but they're the result of actions that you can take. So my favorite one, being an exercise physiologist, is getting 150 minutes of moderate or vigorous physical activity per week. But there's others that are equally important, honestly. In the nutrition category, getting at least 5 servings of fruit and vegetables per day. Also, 20 minutes of relaxation breathing per day for stress reduction with the brain and mind. Also, at least 7 hours of sleep per night. You know, we want good quality sleep, but we need quantity of sleep as well. And finally, at least 64 ounces of water intake per day. And, you know, I'm a bigger guy, so I might need even a little bit more than 64 ounces. So those are 5 actionable steps that an individual can take. They can check off the list every day to see if they've done those.
That's a great list. A really good list, Pat, for 2 reasons. One, it's short and easy to remember, and we'll reinforce it again. But secondly, you added a factor in here in your short list to the many, many other lists out there that highlight what we're talking about, bringing heart and brain together. And that is you added stress, stress reduction with your brain and mind. And why that is just so powerful and certainly super helpful in this podcast, where the essence of the Total Brain podcast is in our 30 minutes to look at how do we get from knowing to doing with respect to mental health and the brain, but we're increasing and everybody's increasingly aware now, it's the same principles in terms of the heart and the brain as well. The knowing to doing gap that I'd like to talk about in the latter part of this podcast, I'd like to take us through the why, the what, and the how. And it seems to me that the why and the what are kind of pretty well known, but the kind of surprise that people have that it's actually the how, the getting from knowing to doing, is challenging for people. So I'd like to leave that till the end once we've finished with the why and the what. But, you know, Pat, that list that you gave, your five, is just so practical and simple. I would just like to, though, just rapidly try to remember the seven, Life's Simple Seven from the American Heart Association, their tips, because they're really interesting and they don't include the brain, but they're really powerful and they've got enormously rich underpinning. It's manage blood pressure, control cholesterol, reduce blood sugar, get active, eat better, lose weight, and stop smoking. So everyone's heard of those. Can you just begin by giving us some essence of the gravitas of the evidence? And, you know, for me, it was really fascinating having done my PhD before I switched to the brain in serum lipids in the heart. And the Framingham study at that stage was really just hitting the mainstream. It changed the whole nature of medicine. Can you give people a sense of the gravitas of that data and why it's been so influential?
No, thank you. And thank you for taking us back to the Framingham Heart Study. I mean, in reality, that's where a lot of this really began. Identifying what we now think of as risk factors, and certainly cholesterol, blood pressure, and smoking were really the top three independent risk factors. But we know that there's more to it than that. There's activity and nutrition, diabetes. There's a lot of other factors that play into this. At the American Heart Association, we started looking at how do you actually define ideal cardiovascular health? So we came up with this rubric of Life Simple Seven. And as you say, it's activity, nutrition, weight, smoking, tobacco, cholesterol, blood pressure, and glucose. Those are the seven domains. The reality is, you know, the missing link to that is stress and emotions. I liken it to, again, we used to think of disease, you know, with, you know, and especially cardiovascular disease, where you had a blockage and those blockages kind of grew like rings on a tree. And eventually they would restrict blood flow, causing chest pain. If it blocked off completely, it could cause a heart attack. And so then we look at the numbers, you know, the biometrics like blood pressure and cholesterol. And then we would move to the behaviors like diet and exercise. And then finally look at some of the emotions, you know, anxiety, depression, and stress. What we're doing now is we're really flipping that around. The stress and emotions, just how you lead your life, your overall well-being impacts your behaviors. Those behaviors impact your numbers, your blood pressure and your cholesterol. And those factors impact whether you're going to have disease or not. So really, stress and emotions is really kind of at the center of all of this work. And what we've been doing then over the past few years is, okay, what are the factors for brain health? And in reality, it's many of the same factors that are the Life Simple Seven. But obviously, the stress reduction and brain health has to be added to that equation.
Yeah, great summary, Pat. Great summary. So that's the why to some degree. Because if you don't get this, that, you know, you don't want your heart clogged up, obviously, and you don't want a stroke. I don't think anything's more engaging to people about at some point, of course, they want to do something. That's the why. You've given us some sense of the context of the level of evidence, which has been amazing over the last few decades. Just before we go to the how, this remarkable challenge that still, despite the fact that this is so simple, the evidence is not great that people actually do it. And so I would like to just briefly go to the Dean Ornish story, because in terms of the big insights about reversing it, reversing all chronic disease, then, of course, rewiring it in the brain. In the reversing it, I don't know of anybody who's got better data than Dean Ornish, and his latest book with his wife, Anne Ornish, is called Undo It. So it's the same as reverse it, of course. This revolution that there's a simple lifestyle change of four things, same as what we're saying. It's the same factors. You stress less, you move more, you eat well, and in his case, he calls it love more, the connection factor. Couldn't get simpler. But the power of it is the level of evidence. I don't know anyone, Pat, that who got better data of showing that you can reverse blocked arteries from those four things. What's your connection that Dean Ornish had on you, and where does he stand in the mainstream of cardiology today?
Yeah, first of all, I love the reversing and rewiring. It just makes so much sense. So Dean Ornish has had a huge impact on my life. This is, you know, early 1990s. I was working in a hospital-based cardiac rehabilitation program. So for those that are not familiar, cardiac rehab is the program that people participate in after they've had a heart attack or a cardiovascular event, such as a bypass surgery, an angioplasty, or a stent. And it runs in phases. So phase one is the inpatient, you know, walking the person in the hallway, walking them up and down steps. Phase two is the immediate post-discharge, where you're monitored, you're on an EKG machine, you're walking on a treadmill. And then eventually you get into a more of a self-directed program. We called that phase three, but we also referred to that as the maintenance program. And I have to tell you, doing something that was referred to as maintenance was just not very motivating to me. I'm like, it's like, can't we do something more than just maintain this? And again, you have to go back to the time period. It really wasn't thought that you could reverse the disease. The thought was, at best, you could slow down or maybe even halt the progression. But wherever that blockage was, if you had a 75% blockage in your coronary artery, it was yours to keep. You just need to make sure that it didn't get any bigger. And so when Dr. Ornish's program for reversing heart disease came out, for me, it was like, oh my goodness, this is the future. This is the future of cardiac rehab. What a awesome way for an individual to really take back the control of their health and literally reverse it and just give people hope. Just like many times a cancer patient, you know, a cancer patient sometimes will say, I'm going to beat this. And they do everything humanly possible. And sometimes they actually do beat it. So I'm like, this is the heart disease equivalent to this. The reality is it is a big lift. So we actually literally created what now would be called an intensive cardiac rehab. So doing really those four elements. So, you know, higher volume of physical activity. We actually put people on a vegetarian or close to a vegetarian diet. The goal was less than 10% of the calories coming from fat. We also spent much more time focused on stress and relaxation. And the fourth component was a support group. And we even had retreats, you know, we really tried to model the program after Dean Ornish's program. What we learned, though, is, you know, we had our cardiac rehab program had about 500 patients in it. And so we put this whole program together and we actually offered it at a very modest price, and only 11 people signed up for it. So that's the challenge. It's how do you get this mainstream? How do you get more than 11 people out of 500 to be willing to do this type of program?
It is amazing. It's this great segue to our final section about the how. And in a way, I mean, now there are thousands of people around the world who do his program, but it's many weeks. It's great. But to me, the striking thing, Pat, is that his data showed you actually reverse your blockage in your arteries. I mean, he injected dye and showed pictures, data, hardcore evidence that with simply stressing less, eating better, like less saturated fats and other toxic sort of issues, move more and connect better, do that intensely, immersively, and the evidence was reversal. And he calls it now, his data is so powerful. Let's not forget, he's got it reimbursed through Medicare and through a number of insurance companies now, because the data is so strong. If you do it, and that's the big if I want to end off on. How can it be possible? How can it be possible, though, Pat, with this data at this level of evidence and what he called the simplest lifestyle choice you could imagine, that we're struggling to persuade people to do it? What are we missing?
Well, what we're missing is the stress and emotions part of this. That's the difference between Dean's program and a traditional rehab program. And frankly, this is where the next level of innovation needs to come. And that's where the work we're doing with you is so amazing. Getting people to become more motivated and giving them the skills to actually be successful and literally be successful and reverse their disease. I mean, what an awesome opportunity that would be for somebody to literally change their life and the direction that their life is headed.
Yeah. So let's to unpack that a little, because as you know, in Total Brain and in the Total Brain podcast, the focus is on going from knowing to doing. I reckon at this point, most people have some idea about knowing that they can actually do something about their heart, their immune system, their gut biome, and their brain. So they'll dabble, and we know that's kind of not going to go anywhere. What is stopping them? From a brain point of view, and what we're seeing at Total Brain is that the evidence is that the brain is firstly not evolved for long-term, even medium-term thinking. It is evolved to deal with threat and reward in the present. So we've got a kind of wiring issue of when we think about benefit, it's short-term. And so until we find ways where people can see the short-term benefit, it's so much harder to persuade them to do that down-the-track objective outcome. So what we see as the future is to cadence and as quickly as possible show people benefit. And the quickest way to show people benefit is stress reduction. And in fact, as you know, Pat, the research that we're doing with you in terms of heart rate variability that we're measuring, and we'll soon be measuring it on a phone through the camera, but also real-time measurements by the end of the year. The evidence is that within 3 breaths, for example, of breathing at 6 breaths per minute, you can switch off your stress system. And then training a couple of minutes a day, et cetera, and other breath tools, mindfulness, but in a disciplined, gravitas, immersive presence, being present and doing it with the science of habit behind you. And secondly, and as you know, Pat, most importantly, having your brain assessed and assessing your level of stress and assessing your mental health challenges, that is so empowering to people. When you put those pieces together and then provide people with a platform like ours or a program like yours, or best combine them, which is where we're heading, they're more likely to do it. Why? They're less likely to fail. And I think fear of failure is the greatest reason why when people don't see a short-term benefit, they're going to derail themselves.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree more. And one of the things I think is really very exciting about the work that we're doing and the work that you're doing on heart rate variability is it does give a physiologic measurement. So that's one of the challenges, I think, in the past of getting not only patients to be taking this seriously, but even clinicians at times. What am I measuring? Is this all just simply somebody's self-report that they're feeling better or they have less stress? So now we can actually have a physiologic measure with heart rate variability and blood pressure as even a long-term measure of that, just like on one of the other domains in my background with exercise physiology, where we could measure a heart rate and get somebody, train a person in a target heart rate zone and know that they're going to be able to maximize their exercise training by being in that zone. So we had a physiologic measurement to do that. And now with heart rate variability and the work that you're doing, there's a physiologic measurement to actually give people feedback and then honestly give their clinicians feedback that they're making progress.
It's so spot on. So I love that example of heart rate and heart rate variability. So with heart rate for exercise, it's been so well used in exercise recovery. It's been used really widely and people really can understand it easily. And it's driven most of the sales and this growing interest in biometrics through watches and bands. And it's soon going to be in our clothes and we're going to be measuring it in all sorts of ways. So that's been super successful and people got it, but they were mainly exercise people. Now, the thing with heart rate variability is everybody faces stress, and the variability means you're more in your calm and flexible state. So your heartbeat to beat from second to second is a little variable, and that shows that you're in your calm, flexible state, and you've put a brake on your stress system. And that people can see in the moment, just even on their phone with their camera, using the camera at the back, putting their finger on it and measuring their heartbeat variability. And then with bands measuring it continuously, but they will see, Pat, their stress in the moment, do something to boost it, like 6 breaths per minute, mindfulness, music, a little bit of exercise, all the things you've mentioned, even the right food. And then they'll be able to see the benefit. And that's the point why I think it's the game changer, benefit. Once people see the benefit, then we've changed the metric, we've changed the context, the content, the likelihood and the probability of them committing?
Yeah, it's giving the person a feedback loop. An analogy would be an individual with diabetes, and they have a continuous glucose monitor, and they can see from moment to moment how their glucose is changing, and they can make adjustments on the fly. You know, I need more insulin. I need to eat something to titrate to get that blood sugar at the target zone. And so I could see where this could be something very similar, where you using the heart rate variability as a feedback loop for the patient. Okay, I need to stop and do some 6 breaths per minute. I need to, you know, do something to, you know, get in the way of this stress response that's currently happening to me right now.
So Pat, before we end off on you reinforcing your 5 takeaways again, can we just briefly go through a couple of little additional points? What's your biggest takeaway from exercise and how it affects the heart and the brain? Like, what's the sort of outcome benefit?
So don't get me started on this. So exercise, honestly, it's very important. And there's really two elements. There's being physically active and there's training, exercise training. They're slightly different. And ideally, you want to be doing both. So from the physical activity part of it, we know from population studies that the more active the individual is, and frankly, now, you know, I hear people say, you know, sitting is the new smoking. So just getting up, just moving, just being around is good. But people sometimes have forgot about the art of actual exercising. So even in our guidelines, we say 150 minutes of moderate to vigorous activity per week. Okay, that's great. But when do I exercise and how much do I do? It's challenging with individuals with heart disease because they're on medications that blunt their heart rate response. So using old formulas of a target heart rate are a little bit more challenging now. And that's where, you know, some of the biometrics and some of the wearable monitors may help us so that the individual knows where they are. At the end of the day, you have to remember that the heart is a muscle. If you exercise that muscle, it's going to get stronger. A stronger heart can do more work with less effort. And if it were to become damaged by having a heart attack, a stronger heart is much more likely to survive than a weaker heart. So exercise and physical activity have a direct impact on the health of your heart.
And Pat, not for people who've had a heart attack, but for people who are trying to prevent one and just grow their heart and the health strength, what about interval training? Is there really particular good benefit of that with respect to the heart and the brain?
Yeah, there's some good research that you can do interval training, and you can even combine, you know, resistance training with more aerobic style training. When I first started doing cardiac rehab, we never would have thought of allowing somebody to, say, lift weights. Now it's become much more mainstream. So even before you've had a heart attack, even just for anybody, it's important to be doing both. You know, the aerobic cardiovascular workouts, as well as resistance training to train your muscles. And don't forget about flexibility as well. I even forget that at times myself, to do a good warm up, to be stretching my muscles, and to be doing a good cool down.
Great, great summary. So just to move through the points briefly, the second one of fruit and vegetables, what's the big takeaway about diet with respect to the heart and clogging arteries in the heart and in the brain?
Yeah, so the reason I put fruits and vegetables on there is a lot of times we're talking about things to avoid. So take sodium out of your diet, take fat out of your diet, reduce calories. Those are negative things. Those are things you should avoid. And so that's why I added the fruit and vegetables, because those are things you should be adding to. So fruits and vegetables are loaded with nutrients, number one. They're also loaded with fiber. So, you know, of course, you can overdo anything. You know, some fruits, you know, have a lot of sugar in them. And, you know, if you do have diabetes, you got to be a little bit careful. But at the end of the day, you know, we do know that people that consume at least 5 servings of fruits or vegetables per day have better cardiovascular outcomes.
Yeah, very interesting. And of course, Dean Ornish emphasizes diet hugely. As a vegan myself, I've been sort of amazed at the growing insights about the kind of quality protein that you can get from fruits and vegetables. And I know I've seen Dean interviewed more recently, and he's also sort of pointing people to have a serious look at a vegan lifestyle because of the potential toxic and inflammatory issues from eating animal products. But that's a whole different discussion. But the bottom line is that the quality of nature's gifts is just so cool. And I am, as being an ex-junkie of processed food, and I started off as a vegan junkie, I kept eating the processed vegan food. I am shocked at just the benefit I feel and the cleanliness in my brain, my body feel from just eating as little unprocessed food as possible. It's just amazing. The number of things they put in food that have got potential triggers to me anyway, and to lots of people I speak to. So food is just the nature of the context about it, thanks to Dean and many others like him, have changed a lot. So as you know, with this third point, the stress reduction, that's at the essence of a key wheelhouse for Total Brain, of course. And we're looking and sharing with you so many of the tools and approaches we have to measure the brain, capacities, mental health, and tools to reduce stress in the moment, like breathing tools, meditation, positivity nudges, and then see that benefit in the moment, and then longer-term rewiring with heart rate variability and just other assessments. What about sleep? What's the 7-hour rule for sleep? And any, what are your key tips to people to improve their sleep quality?
Yeah, so sleep quantity is important. So again, 7 is probably the minimum. You know, it's you know, anywhere between 7 to 9 hours of sleep. The higher the quality, the better. So the thing that people can do is really practice good sleep hygiene. So make sure you're sleeping in a quiet and dark place, making sure you're free of distractions, and probably in today's world, free of electronics. A lot of people literally sleep with their phones, and you know, that's, you know, clearly not going to lead to better quality sleep. Some people sleep with their pets. Do what works for you. But when you're meant to be sleeping, you're meant to be doing that and not doing other things. But sleep is incredibly important for overall health, and especially cardiovascular health.
And last but not least, hydration.
Absolutely. Yeah, and this is important that it's, you know, and specifically water. So, you know, you can't replace the water with especially caffeinated beverages, for example, or sugar sweetened beverages. You know, we're really talking about water and hydration. Think of a stream that has a nice flow of water through it, you know, maybe even a little bit of a whitewater rapids versus a swamp. So, you know, which would you want your body to be more like, the stream or the swamp? So having good water intake, again, is just, it's just a good way to start off your day and a good way to lead a good healthy life.
Well, thank you so much, Pat. What a great summary from certainly the most influential organization in medicine that I'm aware of. And you've just been so magnanimous in so many ways, both in our collaboration and today. And I look forward to moving forward with the American Heart Association and Total Brain to reverse it and rewire it and bring those two together. Thank you so much, Pat.
I love it. I love it. Yep. Looking forward to it.
Me too. Thanks, Pat.
Okay.
Thanks. Bye.